impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Dissonance.
Welcome aboard, everybody. This is Smiles Lewis
and Greg York, and broadcasting.
Broadcasting where?
Live from the mothership in Austin, Texas.
That's another live Thursday evening, and we've got our monthly appearance tonight from our good pal Nick Redfern, who's back from his home country and looking to tell us all about what weird stuff's going on. And of course, here in Austin, we try to embrace the weird, and
sometimes the weird embraces us.
And we're trying to make Austin weirder instead of keeping it weird. So, well, guys, welcome back. Thanks for doing the show with us again, Nick and
Ray. Sure. Glad to be back.
So, here we are on Precognitive Dissonance yet again, and here on Anomaly Radio, and of course you can find out, you can look at, listen to past episodes of Precognitive Dissonance at the website by the same name, .com, and Nick's got...
Precognitivedissonance.com for the...
for the slow on the uptake there?
Or the literal-minded...
Well, Nick's got several websites that he's pumping out information through, including a new conspiracy blog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks to, is her name Lindsay? She does the Debris Field and Beyond the Dial and some other blogs.
Oh, Leslie.
Leslie, yeah. Excuse me. Sorry, Leslie. I was going through her sites, and she was like, hey, as if Nick wasn't cool enough, now he's got a conspiracy blog, so...
Well, you know, I think there's some weird things going on in the world, and just getting the information out to people to say, hey, look, you know, things are getting a bit weird. I think if we all can do our little bit, it helps. So.
I agree. I mean, I'm always... This precognitive dissonance, I try deliberately to exclude the paranormal stuff, except when it just comes up.
Parapolitical stuff, right?
No, I'm trying to exclude all the paranormal stuff. No. Parapolitical, yeah, the conspiracy stuff. I mean, it seems like all the shows I work with deal with this topic because it's just where my mind's been the last 10
years.
It's
a strong personal, not obsession, but...
Yeah, it's an obsession.
Well, it's something that piques your interest and, you know, that leads in turn to extensive reading, powerful... mind interfacing with, I'm babbling. I tend to take a healthfully skeptical view of most conspiracy material. And I confess there is a bit of a fatalistic attitude I have towards it. It's kind of like, well, powerful people are powerful people for a reason. You know, they seek power. And yes, at times the aims, the means that they use to achieve their aims are not something that most of us would find terribly palatable, and they're at pains to keep them secret. All we can do is do our best, I guess.
Well, like Nick says, I think we can each do our part to keep the fires of liberty burning bright. So, it's been, it's been just about a month since we last talked on the air, Nick, and you've made a nice quick jaunt across the pond. Why don't you just tell us, start from the beginning, what's the weird weekend?
Yeah, the weird weekend is a conference that's put on every August, the same week of every August, by John Downes, who runs the British Centre for Fortean and Zoology. And the website for that is cfc.org.uk. And John, I guess, is Britain's sort of premier leading monster hunter, cryptozoologist, however you want to term it. And John set the CFC up, or the CFC, as we say, or you say it in the US,
right.
In 1994, with a view to really trying to create an organization that would cater for those people that weren't necessarily interested in all aspects of, I guess, you know, Fortiana and weird phenomena, but more exclusively with respect to mystery animals, whether it be Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, or, you know, more paranormal type sightings of creatures like werewolves and things like that. And so John set the organization up, and then over the years began to build it up in terms of bringing out his own magazine, a quarterly magazine, and self-publishing books and so on. And now the organization is probably the biggest crypto group in the world, and John puts out now professionally produced books that are as good as, you know, anything that you'd find in your normal bookstore. Perfectly bound, you know, photographs, glossy cover, etc., ISBN, and puts on the conference every year and organizes several expeditions around the world, usually two or three a year. And Richard Freeman, who's the zoological director of the organization, and who was himself formerly a head keeper at a major zoo in England, Richard's been on several expeditions on behalf of the group in the last couple of years, one to Mongolia, looking for a strange type of snake or what giant worm said to live there that can reputedly electrocute its victims. And he's made another trip to Thailand looking for giant snakes there, and one to the, to the Gambia looking for sea serpents and reportedly a still surviving dinosaur deep in the Gambia. So he's sort of, the organization really tries to get out there and do a lot of on-site investigations. And then, of course, the conference allows, the Weird Weekend conference allows, you know, the people who come along to learn the latest discoveries that the organization's made. And whereas, you know, the group itself is primarily based around cryptozoology, the conference sort of broadens the scope a little bit so to encompass things like UFOs, crop circles, paranormal issues. You know, John realizes that, yes, there are a lot of people interested in cryptozoology, but equally, you know, people come along and perhaps interested in other areas as well, so John tries to cater for those too. And the conference started, the first one was in 2001, which just a very, very small low-key event, which I think attracted about 30 or 40 people, and last weekend's event attracted just under 200. So it's, you know, it's becoming a big conference now, and it's got a nice, well-established location in the same town or village each weekend. And get a lot of publicity, a lot of feedback, and a good range of speakers on a whole, you know, various topics. So it seems to be going down well, and as I said, catering for all the more down-to-earth paranormal angles and more esoteric ones, as well. So,
is this conference about the same time every year?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's the same weekend. It's last weekend, and it's now going to be, or it has been and will be, for as long as John wants to run it.
Okay, so
the same weekend.
So it happened right before September 11th, the very first one in 2001?
Yeah, it literally did. It was sort of a couple of weeks beforehand, and it doesn't really too much get into conspiracy theories, but it's more centered around just sort of 40 and paranormal unsolved mysteries along those lines. But as I said, you know, there aren't really that many big conferences in England now. There's the 14 Times and Convention, but
yeah,
even that's not on this year. They're not holding
really?
One. Yeah, they're deciding not to put one on. And there aren't really any big major UFO conferences. So for people who want to attend a big conference where it's not just, you know, you go down and then you leave, but it's actually like a 3 or 4 day event. Mm. Although it's called the Weird Weekend, I should stress, it actually starts on the Thursday night at John's house. John's got a big old English home that goes back to about the 1400s.
Cool.
And he inherited it through his family. And it's literally, you know, like something out of Hound of the Baskervilles, big old stone fireplace and low ceilings built, you know, when the people were smaller, sort of 500 or 600 years ago. And so what he does, on the Thursday, he has like a big cocktail party, and all the village kids come round, and they have put on, you know, like a little games for the children and things like that in his backyard, which is huge. Then on the Friday, there's sort of an introduction, Friday night lectures from about 7 till 10, where there's usually about 2 lectures and, again, a few entertainment things going on. And then the conference kicks off Saturday about 11 o'clock through till about 10, and from about 11 o'clock till about 6 o'clock on the Sunday. So it's like a... Yes, it's a big conference, informative conference, but it's also entertaining, and you know, informative, and there's lots of interaction between the audience, you know, lots of time for questions, and as I said, a few entertainment things for the kids as well. So it becomes more like a, you know, like a family village event, if you like, almost.
I read the log entries that Mrs. Downs wrote in the course of the weekend a little earlier this afternoon. I was kind of tickled and delighted to see that Darren Nash, who writes the blog Tetrapodzoology, was apparently one of the speakers there.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get to see Darren's lecture. Excuse me, I was actually flying in still at that, well, driving down, I should say, when they kicked off on the Saturday morning. But luckily, I got to see most of them. But Darren, I mean, Darren's, I think, you know, a major contribution to cryptozoology, because on the one hand, he is very knowledgeable in down-to-earth zoology, shall we say, got a firm and grounded head on his shoulders, yet he's also learned in cryptozoology as well. And I think it's good to have people who understand regular zoology commenting on cryptozoology. You know, I think sometimes there's, you know, this idea that people who are into cryptozoology are amateurs, you know, where Darren is a pure professional, shall we say.
Lends an air of credibility.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's not to take away, certainly, from the important work that you know, straightforward cryptozoologists do, but I think from the media perspective, there is this tendency to think that if you're a cryptozoologist, you don't really know anything about mainstream zoology, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I think you do, unfortunately, get that at times. I mean, I don't subscribe to that myself, but I think the media tends to portray that.
Well, yeah, it's like all the upstart alternative science things like ufology, Freudian, cryptozoology.
Mm. Well, and I think it's more generally kind of a Western cultural meme, if you will, that if you don't have accreditation, if somebody else hasn't said, yes, he's jumped through all the hoops, we've kind of lost faith in the devoted amateur. You know, and I always like to remind people that, you know, the original meaning of the term amateur was not someone untrained or unpolished. It was someone who does a thing for the love of it.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, I mean, you know, you go back to the sort of the 19th century, have these 19th century explorers and naturalists. You know, had it not been for those people, we wouldn't be, you know, have an understanding of half the things we do today. You know, people just going out and, you know, hacking their way through the forests of South America or Africa, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and coming back with these amazing stories of some of the creatures they saw that, you know, today modern science has classified, whether, you know, the mountain gorilla or the you know, the just straightforward animals, if you like, but at that time, 150 years ago, certainly nobody knew existed, like the giant panda. And I think the fact that we did have these, as you know, as they've come to be known in modern day terms, amateurs going out rather than, you know, just waiting for a university grant to say, okay guys, off you go, you know, we owe them a big debt, I think. And I think, as you Craig rightly said, that has been lost to some extent.
So what were some of the other lectures at the conference?
Well, there was the good thing, as I said, is that John's, you know, encompassed a lot of different areas. And Matthew Williams, a friend of mine, gave an interesting one on crop circles, which was, Matthew's actually done a number of lectures for John on crop circles. And, you know, people say, well, what can the same speaker say over and over? And the good thing about Matthew is he actually lives in the heart of crop circle country, which is primarily the county of Wiltshire in England, where there are a huge number of reports every year and have been for at least, probably getting on for nearly 30 years now. And Matthew, he knows a lot of the people in the field, the researchers, the investigators, the witnesses, and literally lives a stone's throw away from, you know, the major fields where every year these formations appear. And having sort of delved into the subject for about 15 years now, he's got sort of a rich history and knowledge, and, you know, he's also become friends with a lot of the farmers in the area who quite willing to speak to about their experiences, etc. And Matthew gave kind of like a combined lecture that covered a whole range of different phenomena related to crop circles. And obviously with this being, if you like, a crypto conference as well, Matthew encompassed some of that, and one of the things he talked about was the issue of I'm not sure if we mentioned this on the show once before, actually, but he went into more detail, so I can tell you about that. So-called shadow creatures having been seen in crop circles, where people have photographed a crop circle and a shadowy creature has appeared within the crop circle that couldn't be seen by the naked eye and couldn't be seen by the camera viewfinder, yet that nevertheless appeared when the picture was developed or, you know, downloaded if it was done through a digital camera. And Matthew's found or been given a number of these photographs which quite clearly show what appear to be, in some cases, sort of human-sized, shadowy, dark creatures, and in other sizes slightly smaller. And in one or two cases, that almost look like hooded, like, you know, like a classic ghostly hooded monk type character. And one of the things that was certainly asked of me after my lecture was, my lecture was on British Bigfoot reports. I was asked if, you know, there could be a tie-in with some of these creatures, that maybe they're not sort of shadow creatures as such, but is it possible that they're some sort of like hairy or furry, you know, man-like being, like a Bigfoot type entity? Which is an interesting theory in itself, given that a number of the British type of Bigfoot type reports seem to have paranormal origins, you know, and so then you have this situation where these dark, large figures are seen in crop circles. And so Matthew delved into that quite deeply, the whole angle of, you know, what these things are. And one of the strangest things was that a number of these beings actually been seen in formations which are provable, have been proven to be made by man, you know, sort of so-called hoaxes, but as Matthew calls them, he doesn't call them crop circle fakers, he calls them crop circle makers.
Is he among that crowd?
Yeah, Matthew's made some himself. He's actually the only person in the world who's ever been arrested, charged and convicted for causing criminal damage to a field by making a crop circle. Now, Matthew gets quite angry when people consider him to be a faker, if you like, or a hoaxer, because that's not his role, if you like, or his angle. What basically happened was, and again this is something that Matthew discussed in his lecture, is that Matthew, a few years ago, when he really got interested in the subject, and he moved down to Wiltshire to live, you know, people were saying, well, some people were saying that crop circles are made by UFOs, some were saying they're made by the Earth, some were saying it was just some unknown intelligence, and others were saying they were made by people. Now, Matthew took the view, which, in my mind, is quite a logical view. What he did was to say, well, if people are saying there's no way that human beings can make these, why don't I do a scientific experiment and see if I can make one? So he spent a lot of time learning the so-called and alleged practices and guidelines that the makers would use, you know, to create these things with rollers, etc., and laser lights to guide them with right angles, etc., at night, and had a go and had a few aborted attempts that didn't work out, and then finally made one. However, word got out that, because he basically announced it, that Matthew was going to make this, and somebody informed the police, and then he got charged, and he got just a small nominal fine, and it was really just, you know, far smaller than anything else, that somebody was just trying to make a point in the police force, I mean, to say, you know, if you do this, you're liable to get prosecuted.
Yeah.
But what's weird is that Matthew found that, and again, as he mentioned in the lecture, that in the formations that he made himself, he began to experience weird phenomena. He began to see strange balls of light flitting over the fields, not always at a very high level, like a star or a satellite, but actually like 50 to 100 feet above the field. Very small balls of light, certainly not what you would call a UFO in the nuts and bolts term, at least, but more like golf ball size to tennis ball size, very fast moving, highly reflective balls of silvery white light. On a couple of occasions, he experienced missing time and actually lost somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes, and to this day really doesn't know what happened. Also began to experience a number of very bizarre synchronicities. For example, creating a crop circle design on his computer that he was going to make in the field, only to find that another group that makes these things as well had come up with practically the same design on the same night.
Which is very suggestive. A couple of different possibilities, but...
Well, what Matthew doesn't claim to have all the answers. Matthew thinks that a lot of the formations, and particularly the intricate ones, are made by people, but where he differs from the debunkers, the skeptics, etc., is that he feels that there's some sort of intelligence that either we pull in by wanting to make these things or that somehow guides us to make them, and that it uses the crop circle makers as almost like its own vehicle, its own tool. Now, Matthew admits, you know, he doesn't know what this phenomenon is, and admits it could be extraterrestrial, but he doesn't believe it's as simple as, you know, an advanced technology beaming something down to the ground and flattening the corn.
Yeah.
He thinks that the circle makers are, if you like, the equivalent of like a puppet. And that the irony is, he, you know, he actually does feel that maybe people are being guided to make certain formations to, specifically to make public or the media, I suppose, think about what these formations mean, you know, in terms of does one perhaps, is one perhaps suggestive of, you know, something to do with environmental collapse or something like that. So he feels that, ironically, that, you know, he's being attacked by the very people who are supporting the idea that there's a weird phenomenon going on, when he actually believes that too. He just believes that the way that the circles are formed differs from the other people's beliefs.
Miles is sorry about that. Miles is scrolling through a web page of liberally sprinkled with aerial photographs, and one of them is
Hello Kitty.
Hello Kitty.
It's my favorite crop.
I thought it was kind of interesting in reference to what you were saying earlier about media perception,
mm-hmm.
that you know this fellow is labeled a faker.
Yeah.
When you know, nobody's really established what constitutes a real crop circle.
Well, no, I mean, that's a good point, Craig. I mean, the thing is that, you know, by definition there are real crop circles because there are crop circles and we can walk in them, so they're, by definition they're real. But it does come down to the interpretation of what or who makes these things. And I think a lot of people, certainly I know from speaking to Matthew, a lot of people are quite disturbed by the idea that maybe human beings are being manipulated in some way to make these things, and perhaps it has more esoteric, magical origins than it does nuts and bolts craft origins. There's a lot of, you know, full-on extraterrestrial believers who believe there's a connection with the crop circles want us to accept. And I think, you know, also when you look at England. When you go to England, England's kind of, I guess, in many ways, a strange place. It's sort of steeped in ancient history and folklore. A lot of the old towns and villages haven't changed for centuries. And then you suddenly find these weird crop formations in these areas that are already steeped in centuries-old folklore, tales of demons and fairies and elementals and all sorts of things. You know, I think a lot of people, perhaps outside of England, have the approach that, oh, you know, England's a modern-day country, and people are seeing nuts and bolts UFOs, and they're beaming laser beams down or whatever to make crop circles.
Microwaves.
But then you find it's, you know, it's actually very, very different to that. And I think that's one of the areas that a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate till they get over there, that maybe we're dealing with, you know, an age-old phenomenon or something that's just found a new way to manifest or communicate through people even.
Except for the fact that they're essentially temporary structures, because obviously the rest of the field is going to get harvested at some point, and the formation is going to disappear. Especially looking at the aerial images that Miles has been scrolling through, I was struck by, you know, there's not a tremendous amount compared to, say, megalithic sites, but things like the Nazca Plain, and some of the chalk figures in England itself, one of which I seem to remember is actually kind of racy. you know exactly the one
I know
talking
exactly
about.
The one you mean. That's the Kern Man, it's called.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things, because these sites are so ancient and the civilizations that created them have pretty much vanished, we can't really quiz them as to what was happening to them when they were, you know, down in the Alto Plano, making these colossal figures of hummingbirds and spiders, you know. But you have to wonder if the same sort of phenomena wasn't guiding them or manipulating them.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, you talk about, for example, the Kerman, And a lot of these ancient white horses that are painted on or carved into the hillsides in England, all of these, and for example Stonehenge, the Avebury Stone Circle, all these are all in the county of Wiltshire, which is the same county where today we have the crop circles. Now, you know, you could argue that in the same way that ancient man constructed Stonehenge in a circle, and in the same way that the Avebury Circle was constructed because of its name in a circle, then today in the same area, modern day man is constructing crop circles. Now, you know, is that coincidence, or is it, as you, you know, suggested, a possibility we've got some sort of intelligence or phenomenon that's guiding people throughout the ages in different ways for whatever reasons or purposes? You know, we just don't know. Whether it's to try and teach us something, whether it's to give us a message, you know, think about the world, the universe, I don't know, but it's intriguing that, you know, these parallels exist.
I you know, keep flashing back to my early interest in the crop circle stuff as it was coming into vogue, so to speak, and we had our Busty Taylor and I forget the other fellow.
Colin Andrews, people.
It was a similar sounding name, but not the Colin Andrews. It was another guy, unless that's the guy that usually was with Busty Taylor. But and then of course, now I can't remember his name either. The fellow that
Terence Maiden?
No,
George Wingfield.
Wingfield, yeah. George Wingfield. Thank you, George Wingfield. And you know, I really felt caught up in it, and his main interpretation was that whatever the consciousness or intelligence behind these formations, it was warning us about agricultural issues and the dangers inherent in food supply. I know that there certainly has been a lot of ecological interpretation of these things, and I think on a previous show you mentioned that there are official UK documents that show the interest of the government there in this phenomena for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's some going back to the 40s where British intelligence was looking at these formations actually being found on mainland Europe during the Second World War, and the first thought was it was the Germans leaving coded messages. But then again, you know, then you realise that these things have been seen for years. It's just to what extent I think the media particularly have taken notice or not taken notice. You know, the ones in the 80s, certainly in the 90s, and today, whenever they appear, the media's all over them. But I mean, I'll give you another example that I mentioned in my lecture at the Weird Weekend that's relates to crop circles. Although the lecture was actually on British Bigfoot reports, one part of the story did relate to crop circles, which I'll just basically tell you about. There was a weird, very weird Bigfoot type report in the mid-1980s in England at a place called Chartley Castle in the county of Staffordshire, which is the county I used to live in, and about 20 miles from where I used to live. And in 1986, a couple driving home late one night had seen this weird, like a 5-foot-tall chimpanzee, monkey-type creature, but sort of with man-like qualities, more human-like, bounding across the road late at night, and they slammed the brakes on. The husband panicked, stalled the car, then flooded the engine, and they were literally stood or sat in the middle of the road as this thing glared at them and then bounded off into the woods. Well, Chartley Castle, where this was seen last year, was the site of a very complex crop circle formation, which, as fate would have it, me and my wife were over in England for quite a few months last year, and so we went out there when this was found, when it appeared, I should say. And when we were having a walk around it, we found all these peacock feathers in the area, which is very strange considering that the peacock isn't certainly a bird that's native to England. But what's interesting is that peacock feathers have a long history in mythology, and the circular pattern on the feathers was often seen as being like an evil eye or a sign of demonic or evil activity. And one of the theories that was put forward is that maybe this crop formation was made by people and that there was some sort of ancient ritual and rite going on in the area that involved peacock feathers and, you know, praying to ancient deities and dark gods, that sort of thing. So, you know, then you find it's tied in with a this appearance of this weird Bigfoot-type creature in the same area. So again, it goes to show that, you know, maybe the crop circles aren't as nuts and bolts as people think, but they really are tied in with sort of archaic rites, rituals, beliefs, etc.
Well, I was just, again, going through some crop circle images and found that one, the mowing devil woodcut that we mentioned last time. With the peacock stuff and the evil eye, I've always been fascinated, you know, by, okay, in all the weird phenomena literature, whether it's UFO occupants or Mothman or even some in black cases and some Bigfoot cases, the fiery eyes, whether it be red or some other color, the self-illuminating eyes, the self-defeating apparatus, and
on demand.
And the fact I learned around when I was thinking about all that, I found out that, well, in certain parts of the world where there's tigers and lions and such, that the local villagers would wear masks on the backs of their head with pronounced eyes, and the idea was that the animals that might be looking at them as lunch or dinner would see the eyes and think, oh, I'm being watched. And so if you look at, there's so many examples in the natural world, whether it be butterflies or peacocks or spiders, where there are markings. What's that?
Caterpillars.
Yeah, where there are markings that are obviously intended to confuse potential predators.
Mm. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, I don't subscribe to the more extreme end of the intelligent design notion, but I can't help but look at a lot of facets of nature and go, you know, chance, even over hundreds of millions of years, arriving at this particular feature, you know, is amazing.
Yeah.
One of the things I also wanted to mention, you mentioned the Matthew Williams talking about the photographs of quote-unquote shadow people and somebody bringing up the Bigfoot connection. I was immediately thinking about Rob Riggs's book about Bigfoot creatures in the Big Thicket and the idea of them having some sort of camouflage or some kind of some way of being not seen by the human eye. But so what else was part of your talk at this weird week?
Excuse me. Well, I basically spoke about the book I've got out right now called Man Monkey, which is a study of, it's actually an old British, Bigfoot type report from the late 1870s. But it has, again, this has sort of paranormal, if that's the right term, overtones to it, where this creature reputedly haunts a large area of woodland on a canal known as the Shropshire Union Canal. And it's been seen on various occasions from the 1800s through to the present day. But pretty much all of the cases seem to have these weird spectral, paranormal, vanishing in the blink of an eye aspects to them. And again, interestingly enough, most of the witnesses report the self-illuminating glowing eyes, in some cases red, in the other case like a sparkling white silvery colour. So what I did over the literally going back to when I was about 21, 22, I sort of delved on and off into looking into these cases and wrote a few local newspaper articles and asked if anybody had ever had any knowledge of it to come forward. And so over about 2 decades, I put together probably somewhere in the region of about 20 reports, somewhere I'd interviewed the people personally, somewhere a century ago, there was no way you could interview them now, of course, and other ones which were sort of secondhand, and just collated them into this new book. And that was the lecture I presented at the conference, was basically talking about the man-monkey story as it's become known, but also in the bigger context of what this case may mean for the larger and wider body of British Bigfoot-type stories. Now, there are certain British Bigfoot researchers who take the view that, you know, the British Bigfoot is simply an ape hiding out in the forests and woodlands. I don't personally subscribe to that theory because I don't think it's possible for something, you know, a whole colony of giant apes to hide in a country the size of England. Never mind how, you know, big or small the woods are, I don't think it's just feasible without being caught or found. And the fact that, you know, the locations are kind of unusual, prehistoric burial mounds, stone circles, areas of historical and prehistoric significance, time and time again, you know, these are the locations where these things are seen, or ancient crossroads, ancient waterways, ancient Roman roads that the Roman Empire built 2,000 years ago. So I think there's something weirder going on. So that was sort of the area that I delved into. And the case I mentioned at Chartley Castle, this particular encounter, this one ties in very, very closely with a lot of the British reports, where these creatures almost, they seem to exhibit an air of malice and hostility, but then at the last moment they seem to back off. And what I mean by that is that there are endless reports in Britain of so-called Bigfoot type creatures charging cars and charging carts and horse and carts hundreds of years ago, only at the very last second to back away and not actually cause any physical harm. And it's almost as if they're trying to instill fear in the people that see them in some sense, but not actually capable of, you know, committing bodily harm, which if these things aren't necessarily physical in the way we understand the term, would make sense. But I actually touched upon the issue that Rob touches on in his book, the idea that maybe these things aren't paranormal, but is it possible that they're a highly evolved creature that perhaps has senses and powers that we don't understand? That, you know, if these things can camouflage themselves optically, that might look to us as if they are paranormal, you know, blinking out in a second, if you like. But maybe that is like a unique attribute, like something like a chameleon that we don't understand fully, rather than being, you know, a magical or an occult type creature, shall we say. So basically that was sort of the theme that I was speaking on, just following the path of this old 19th century British story through to the present day and looking at what it may mean to the bigger Bigfoot mystery, not just in the UK but elsewhere as well, and the reasons why time and time again these things seem to elude capture, they seem to vanish in the blink of an eye, and the more you delve into them, you do find these more problematic in some ways angles, you know, the nature of where the things are seen and their actions and activities.
Can you sum up the connection to the bridge scenario you blogged about? In Manuki?
Yes. There's one big story I have in the book that kind of ties in some ways with the so-called Mothman story in the United States. Now, the man monkey, and again I mentioned this quite deeply in the lecture as well at the Weird Weekend, the man monkey story dates from 1879. And a lot of these British Bigfoot reports have been made in the vicinity of ancient bridges, ancient crossroads, ancient waterways, that sort of thing. Now, if we jump forward to 1967, we have the collapse of the bridge at Point Pleasant, West Virginia, that occurred at the height of the Mothman scare and sightings in 1967 that John Keel chronicled in The Mothman Prophecies, where he had this sort of spectral, brooding, giant, shadowy winged creature sort of hovering around the area at the same time that UFOs and men in black were being seen and poltergeist activity and all sorts of strangeness, which culminated in the collapse of the bridge at Point Pleasant and the deaths of numerous people. Well, one of the things that I found when researching the book was that there was a sighting of a very similar sort of weird creature at a place called the Tay Bridge in Scotland in also 1879, the year that the man monkey was seen over the bridge at the Shropshire Union Canal. And this creature became known as the Shuggy, and Shug is a derivative of a term named, there's two potential origins. One is an old English term meaning shaggy, and another one is an old English term meaning demon. But they're all derivatives on this particular old English word. And the story is that late one night in 1879, this wild, hairy creature was seen on a windswept night, sort of hanging on the cables and the struts of the Tay Bridge. And shortly afterwards, sure enough, there was a catastrophic collapse of the bridge, in which literally dozens of people were killed when the train going over the bridge plunged into the waters below. And I point out in the book a number of other cases where people driving home late at night in Staffordshire and Shropshire, the two main counties where these things have been seen, they've been driving across reservoirs, for example, rivers that had a bridgeway, and again they'd seen hairy creatures jump out of the darkness at their vehicle and then, you know, jump back at the last minute. Now, one of the theories that's been put forward is that a lot of ancient bridges, roadways, are built on ley lines, and that perhaps there's a connection here that it literally opens a doorway maybe for these things to enter into our realm of existence from somewhere else, and that they do so along these ancient waterways and ancient pathways. I mean, that's as good a theory as any other. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that, you know, I don't know why there are so many of these reports in the vicinity of bridges that seem to end in disaster and tragedy. But certainly they do. And even the one on the Shropshire Union Canal, that's the main story in the book, the original story points out that when the encounter occurred, that the man who witnessed this thing jump out at him and scare the daylights out of him, basically, when he was reported to the police actually linked this particular sighting with the death of a man who'd supposedly drowned in the river very recently before. So here again you have like a case with just a one-off case with one person having been killed or died in the vicinity, immediate vicinity of the bridge where this creature was seen, and then you have a whole range of other cases from Scotland to Point Pleasant and elsewhere, which, you know, when you begin to look at it, it suggests parallels, but I don't think we sort of know enough about it just yet to say what those parallels are implying.
It occurs to me, too, that there's some echoes of the kind of behavior that you see in the man monkey and the shug ape in a lot of North American Bigfoot reports, or and usually the other thing that strikes me is usually these aren't what you think of as Bigfoot. They're more man-sized or a little bit smaller, but attacks on cars pop up fairly frequently in the American literature. John Keel's Strange Creatures from Time and Space mentions a number of them.
He, in a number of his books, he talks about the prevalence of Lover's Lane location attacks by these creatures banging on the hood and leaving scratch marks or things like that.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because there was actually a large scale of Bigfoot-type sightings at a place called Bolam Lake in the north of England from roughly about 2002 to 2003, maybe 2004, and this was almost like a flap type scenario where there were countless sightings in the woods and around the lake that started and then finished as abruptly as they began. And in those cases there were somewhere, I think, either two or three sort of classic Lover's Lane type experiences, you know, where a guy and his girlfriend were out in the woods parked up and suddenly this thing hammered on the windows, or they could see it looming through the trees at like 10 or 15 feet away and then it vanished. And again, you know, this is a classic scenario that Keel talked about, and also in the Bolam Lake reports, the creatures had the classic sparkling eyes. There are even reports of electromagnetic disturbances to television equipment, and even when the BBC went out with their TV crew, their equipment malfunctioned in the direct vicinity. So again, you know, it seems that what's going on in the US is actually being paralleled elsewhere as well. It's just, you know, to what extent people learn about these cases and can join the dots together and make the parallels, if you like.
You mentioned several talks at the Weird Weekend that invoke UFOs but that weren't specifically about UFOs. Were there any specific UFO talks?
Not specifically UFOs as such themselves, but I mean, one of the most interesting ones was Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. I don't know if you know Larry and Peter. But Larry and Peter co-wrote a book called Left at Eastgate. And Larry was one of the witnesses to the US Air Force witnesses to the so-called Rendlesham Forest UFO incident in December 1980 in England.
Oh, yeah.
And for those listening who may not be aware of the full story, basically what it relates to is that in December 1980 and through to the mid-1980s, there existed two Royal Air Force bases on the east coast of England, one called Bentwaters and one called Woodbridge. And Bentwaters, because this was the height of the Cold War, and, you know, there was a fear the Russians were going to attack, Bentwaters was leased out to the U.S. Air Force, so there was a U.S. Air Force presence at that base. And although it was controlled by the British Air Force, the base was basically run by the U.S. Air Force. And late in December 1980, there were various reports of weird lights having been seen in the woods around the base, and Air Force personnel were sent out to try and determine what these things were. And there were reports over the course of two or three nights of strange triangular-shaped objects flitting through the trees, of weird little creatures having been seen, of lights beaming down to the ground and actually disabling the launch code systems on the missiles in the underground bunkers. And a lot of weird activity along these lines, which, and all this testimony either comes through the official documents or through the testimony of the US Air Force men that have spoken out about their knowledge or direct involvement. And one of those involved was Larry Warren, and Larry broke the story under a pseudonym to begin with in the early 80s, and then as the story progressed, he felt more comfortable about speaking out and hooked up with Peter Robbins, and the two of them decided to write a book about the case, which came out in 1997, as I said, titled Left at Eastgate. And for me, it's probably the best Rendlesham-related book, because it's actually written by one of the players in the story, rather than, you know, a researcher going back 10 years later or whatever and looking into it afresh. And so Larry's able to give his own unique perspective on his thoughts, feelings, and memories from that time. And Larry's done, you know, a lot of lectures on the subject throughout the years. I think he got to the point where, you know, he felt that he got all the information out to people and didn't want to just keep going over old ground. So what Larry and Peter did at this year's weekend was something a little bit different and interesting. They focused instead on the things that they specifically left out of the book, some of the other weird stuff that happened that wasn't directly related to Larry's case, but was related to weird things that happened to him and Peter when they were writing and researching the book. And a lot of this related to things like official surveillance by the intelligence community, if you want me to go into that a little bit.
Well, I'm trying to remember. It seems like there's been so many players with the Rendlesham case. I know that there's at least one witness who claims that he was likely drugged.
That's Larry, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Larry's story is that he was out, there was an initial sighting, there's kind of some confusion as to exactly what occurred on which night, because you had two or three and maybe even more parties of airmen out in the woods on patrol in different locations, and some having different experiences, and then all coming back and sharing the stories, and then, you know, some of the stories that came out had aspects of one encounter involved in them and, you know, aspects of another, because a third party was telling the story, if you like. So it became a little bit garbled. But basically, Larry's encounter occurred on probably the second night, I think, or the third. And he reported seeing this, some sort of light come across the field, which sort of exploded in the air, and in its place was this, like a classic UFO-type object. And it was almost like there was an air of unreality about it. He reported how this thing, you know, sort of ominously hovering in the trees in the woods. And it was, he said, as they approached it was almost like their shadows were moving at slightly a pace behind the airmen, as if time was somehow being slowed down in some respects. And he reported seeing some small creatures that had cat-like faces, and there was sort of a distinct air of weirdness and unreality about the whole situation, and, you know, nobody really knew what was going on, and there were people out there with cameras filming the event, etc., and and marking the, you know, the responses of the airmen, see how they're responding to it, and a lot of, you know, strange aspects that made some people think, well, is it some sort of psychological operation to test the airmen, you know, like a hologram? Larry tends to take the view that it was a literal physical object, you know, and points to the fact that there were ground markings found, etc., and things like that. And, you know, Larry was there, we weren't. So, but the story got weirder for Larry, because he talks about how a day or so later he was essentially drugged and taken to one of the underground bunker parts of the base and had a weird experience where he saw a similar craft apparently stored under the base. And now, whether the next part actually happened to him or it was a relative to having been drugged, even he admits he doesn't know, but he reported seeing some sort of like creature behind a thick glass, what seemed like a smoky glass wall, that seemed to contact him telepathically and seemed to have knowledge of his past and even his future. And he was in, as I said, like a semi-drug state, and he doesn't even to this day know if, you know, these were fake, spurious thoughts, creative thoughts, you know, implanted in his mind to discredit a more down-to-earth UFO encounter, if you like. So if he spoke out, you know, people would just dismiss the whole thing. He doesn't know to what extent, you know, part of it was like a psyop, program, and if part of it was a genuine UFO encounter, or, you know, where the truth ends and the disinformation begins, if you like.
Well, I would comment that I think his has always, even without the secondary drug-induced or drug-addled, whatever, episode, his story is definitely the more sensational than the ones that I originally heard. Because I remember, you know, what was public was the audio tape that was made by one of the groups going through the woods, and there's references to, as you say, different groups of people on different nights having different encounters of everything from, as the old skeptical saw goes, oh, a light shining through the woods that was, you know, just a lighthouse a long way away. But also, I think I remember hearing on the tape, you know, the discussion of lights moving through the trees. But then, at some point, I guess, as this became more talked about, this wild story emerges from out of left field, the left gate, whatever, left at East Gate, rather. And not only is it his initial story more sensational than the rest, but then there's the added level of this whole other mind bender.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, in fairness to Larry, you know, he doesn't say, you know, this is 100% what I know to be the truth. You know, he can state with certainty he was out in the field and saw the UFO and saw that what appeared to be creatures and a heavy military contingency and, you know, other personnel out there who he recognized and who he was friends with and he worked with every day. But by his own admission, you know, he's hazy on what happened when, apparently what happened was that he was taken to, basically, he was told to meet somebody outside the base later, or on one part of the base late at night, and next thing, you know, he entered this groggy state, and by his own admission, you know, if you ask him, he will say hand on heart, he doesn't know to what extent the experiences that he recalled underground actually happened, or if it was some sort of stage-managed, stage-crafted, you know, psy-op event to confuse his mind even further. He just doesn't know, and he freely admits that. You know, he's not trying to push the idea that he went into an underground base where there was, you know, like a Dulcie-type alien base under Bentwaters. That's how
his mother took off her mask and ate a baby.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it appears to him to, you know, to be, but he doesn't know if that actually was what happened, so to speak. But, I mean, you know, as I said, his story to me is interesting because we do know that there were three or four nights of activity, and it's one of these cases where it's not like Roswell, you know, where it was 60 years ago and pretty much everybody's dead. Bearing in mind this occurred 27 years ago, and I think Larry's only like 45 now. You know, these were young guys, sort of 18, 19, 20. And I don't think there's anybody, bar maybe one or two people, who aren't still alive. You know, everybody involved in the case is still alive. Some are willing to talk to varying degrees. Some aren't willing to talk at all. Some, like Larry, have tried to tell their entire story. excuse me. So I think in that respect, the case is a good one because it can continually be investigated, but I don't think we'll ever really know the story unless, you know, the government declassifies all its files, regardless of what files exist, purely because there is this confusion as to who was where on which nights and who recalls which incidents and which party were here, which party were there, and, you know, particularly when it's late at night in woods as well, and it's over the Christmas period, and, you know, time kind of gets, people get confused as to which night they were on duty, which night they were off for Christmas, that sort of thing. So I think that's the problem with the case. But as I mentioned at the lecture at the Weird Weekend, I mean, Larry and Peter have both spoken extensively throughout the years in England on the case, because it sort of pretty much is seen as like a British Roswell, if you like, you know, in terms of the number of people and government involvement and et cetera, et cetera. But Larry and Peter have done, you know, their conventional, if that's the right term, lecture on the case on many occasions, for example, for people like Graham Birdsall's UFO magazine and things like that. But what I found interesting was sort of the wealth of experiences and strange things that have happened that weren't necessarily relative to Larry's story in the book, but that surfaced later as time was going on, and that, you know, related to how it seemed that the more that Larry and Peter dug into the story, the more that the intelligence services of today were watching them. And Larry, in particular, for example, spoke about how he had numerous passport problems when he was trying to get over to England, actually had to apply for a new passport or to have it renewed, and then the government said they couldn't find any record of it, and of course this prevented him leaving the US. And then lo and behold, he found that this was related to when he gave a lecture in England and actually discussed sensitive defence activity, as it was called, on British soil. So, you know, at some point in one of his lectures, he concludes, he'd mentioned something that's, you know, either broke the British Official Secrets Act or mentioned sensitive US military activity in England. And it was clearly a case that this was an attempt to prevent him from renewing his passport and actually being able to speak outside the US on this particular case and give it a greater profile.
Was Rindle's, okay, Rindle's room, I always forget this, it was a joint American British base, but there was a part that was specifically run by the Americans?
Well, what it was, the bases have existed for a long time as Bentwaters and Woodbridge, but as the Cold War progressed and then an American presence started to appear in Britain to help defend the country if the Russians attacked, obviously you have to put them somewhere. So a decision was taken to move the British personnel from Bentwaters to another base and then allow an American contingency to come in and, you know, establish their missiles and aircraft there as like a frontline defence to assist the British Royal Air Force. So it technically existed as a Royal Air Force base beforehand and was then transformed into a US base. And it technically it was under the control of the British Royal Air Force, but day-to-day running and emergency procedures did fall under the jurisdiction of the US Air Force. But, you know, in the event of an attack or whatever, it was the British who would say, okay, you know, launch the missiles or whatever.
And that's what I was going to get to. Was it a nuclear base?
Well, you know, the official story is that it wasn't, but Larry said, and a number of other airmen have said, yes, it was, that they did have nuclear missiles there that, you know, in the event they'd be needed, that they would be used. But the official story was either no comment or no, they weren't.
Likely, if there were nuclear munitions there, there were bombs, and they would have been probably tactical weapons. By the 1980s, most of the, well, all of Britain's strategic deterrent, if you will, was sea-based. The B-bomber force had been phased out pretty much by the end of the 70s. There were a few Vulcans still flying, you know, as late as the Falklands War, but by and large, Britain had put all of its nuclear deterrents at sea.
Mm-hmm.
I think the decision was made fairly early on in England not to base any kind of ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles.
No, you're actually right there, Craig, that was taken. I should stress that at Bentwaters there was nothing like, you know, huge silos with missiles pointing upwards.
But there were apparently underground bunkers of
there were, and they did apparently have like nuclear-tipped missiles, you know, that would be attached to aircraft and, you know, nuclear capability, that sort of thing.
Well, I was just looking around on the net, and I know that Jenny Randles has put forth a couple of different ideas about it, ranging from the cover-up idea, the idea that maybe the UFO incident was hoaxed to cover for something, some kind of air disaster involving perhaps a plane that may have been carrying one of these devices.
Yeah.
But she also, I think, she and others have looked into the history of the area, and again, like so much of the areas that you research, there's a geographic... the window area idea that this may be yet another area that, for whatever reasons, has a history of other strange phenomena. None of the other historic examples are popping into my head, but I know we've mentioned that before.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting angle, because I also talked about this in my British Bigfoot lecture, is that Rendlesham Forest has a whole history of weird activity, and that was the site many centuries ago of a creature that became known as the Shug Monkey. Very similar to the man monkey in my book. Not a sort of a classic 6-7 foot tall, lumbering Bigfoot type creature, but about a 5 to 5.5 foot tall ape-like creature that could reportedly or reputedly walk on either two or four legs, and on two legs it was kind of like a large ape, and on four legs it kind of lumbered around like a large mastiff, like a large dog. This was directly in Rendlesham Forest. You also get reports from there of sort of classic spectral black dogs that were populated English folklore 300 or 400 or 500 years ago, and that actually led to the legend of the Hound of the Baskervilles. Those sightings occurred in Rendlesham Forest, and today we get reports of big black cats, so like the so-called, you know, black panthers, roaming in the woods. And again, none of these creatures ever get caught. And then you find they're in the same location as the Britain's most famous UFO encounter. And just
fancy
then,
that.
Sorry, go on.
Fancy that.
Sorry, what did you say?
Nothing.
And just down the road from there, you have a place called Orford Ness. Now, Orford Ness is very significant because during the Second World War, it was where the British military began doing all sorts of top-secret experiments with radar, military weapons applications, all sorts of stories about some weapon testings going wrong and people, bodies being found burned on the beaches, and all sorts of strange conspiracy-based technology tales, death rays, things like that. And so, you know, then you find you have this UFO story, which, again, as you mentioned, there have been other theories being put forward. Crash of a top-secret aircraft, crash of an aircraft carrying a military nuclear weapon. Another theory was that at some point perhaps the military had found a way to actually guide or grab, that's the right term, enemy satellites and guide them down to Earth. One theory was that perhaps the Russian satellites had been knocked out of orbit and had been, you know, put on a deliberate descent into the area, or the roughly the area, but maybe that was being brought back to the woods by helicopter and it was dropped, unfortunately, in the woods. There's that theory. There's another theory that was that perhaps the military was trying to devise some sort of holographic device to see how the airmen would react, and the idea was, you know, if you can flummox the airmen and have them just stand there with their mouths wide open in amazement, that would be a good tactical weapon to use on the enemy. You know, you could catch them unawares, and while they decide whether they should shoot or not,
yeah,
you get the first shot in first.
Yeah.
Which is quite a plausible idea, really.
What you were talking about just before that, the business of guiding Russian satellites, dovetails rather interestingly with some technology that Greg Bishop talks about in his book Project Beta, which was actually going on at about the same time at Kirtland Air Force Base in the United States. Greg mentions, I want to say it's Sandia Labs, essentially using a laser to reprogram Russian satellites in orbit so that they fired their maneuvering thrusters, altered their orbit, and basically wound up taking pictures of the middle of the Caribbean instead of Area 51 or Reagan's backyard.
Well, and there's I keep thinking of the incursions on the Nike missile base UFO incidences that happened where over and over for different locations, several different times, there were these mystery helicopters and other unidentified aircraft, UFOs, that were seen near these nuclear weapon facilities and reprogramming the codes and of course, Valet and others have suggested that, yeah, just as you say, this could be a way of testing, you know, some non-lethal psychotronic technology that confounds the observers, the soldiers, whoever you're trying to dupe, to give you just that edge that you need to pull something off. And it's just right up the military's alley. It just sounds like exactly the kind of thing that they would do. But it's also convenient for the ridicule factor, because again, if it was a downed aircraft or some new piece of military hardware, it would be better to shroud it in the air of ridicule that is associated with UFOs and aliens telepathically communicating underneath military bases.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, if you follow that theory, is the fact that, as Larry and Peter both mentioned at the conference, they found themselves under surveillance in the wake of the incident. Now, you know, that does make me wonder sometimes if the military was watching them closely because they were fearful they were going to uncover a military event, if you like. I mean, Peter, for example, talked about how he, you know, had undergone what was quite clearly, for example, mail and telephone surveillance. And Peter did a lot of digging into this and basically got word back that, yes, it was going on, and it was basically twofold. One was to try and determine what they were doing, and the other one was, I guess, to try and spook them and demoralize them and frighten them. You know, actually let them know that they were being watched, because it was made so obvious, because Peter would have mail arrive time and time again that had been opened and resealed in such a fashion as to make it obvious to him that as to what was going on. And I think, you know, that's a good psychological ploy. That's one of the things I found in a number of UFO cases. People point out that, you know, if the government or whoever's listening in, they don't actually have to, you know, like the Hollywood film where you can hear the clicking and so on. That doesn't need to be done today. The technology is far in advance.
Right.
So if it is being done, it's being done at a psychological level, I think, to, you know, some cases, some people, depend on their character, I think, probably would be frightened off. Peter and Larry, to their credit, it pushed them harder to look for the answers. But, I mean, they told a number of stories like this, weird stories about how, you know, repeatedly being stopped at customs when coming back into the US, you know, time and time again, where it was beyond just coincidence, and almost as if, excuse me, there was like a, I guess, like a case of harassment, if you like, to undermine them. And I mean, I well remember when Larry and Peter came over in 97 to promote their book when it was first published, and, you know, they again sort of exhibited major concerns as to, you know, were they being watched and who was watching them and where this was all going to lead to. I mean, they were lobbying for questions to be asked in the British Parliament, and people were trying to get government files released, and a copy of the book was sent to the British Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair, etc. So, you know, it was kind of a strange time, and they were really putting themselves out on a limb. And I think a lot of people at the conference, probably, even those who weren't necessarily directly interested in UFOs, appreciated and found it interesting. But, you know, this was like a real human interest story of two guys investigating something strange and then, you know, getting this official backlash.
Two guys seeking answers, as opposed to seeking
there you
answers.
Go. That's almost a book title.
we've been hearing an awful lot about the Fortean aspect of Fortean zoology and other Fortean subjects at Weird Weekend. Was there anything more in the way of nuts and bolts or flesh and blood cryptozoology?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't want people to think, you know, that the Weird Weekend, but, you know, by its name, it's not just sort of based around, you know, the paranormal and witches and crop circles, etc. No, I mean, the important thing to note is that a lot of people tied to the Centre for Fortean Zoology do have a mainstream background in zoology. For example, Darren Nash, we mentioned earlier, you know, Darren's sort of a mine of knowledge on both aspects, you know, the cryptozoology and standard zoology. Richard Freeman, former head keeper at Twycross Zoo in England, and Richard, basically we had like a panel discussion on the Saturday night, and we discussed, you know, some of those creatures that are perceived as falling into the realm of cryptozoology, but that may actually or should be regarded as falling into the realm of mainstream zoology that science either hasn't classified or that science believes has become extinct. And, you know, we're all sort of polled as to which creatures we felt, you know, might actually fall into the realm of mainstream zoology. Richard is pretty convinced that at some point in the future, particularly in New Guinea or some of the forests of Australia, that somebody's going to stumble across a creature that's known as Megalania. Now, Megalania, for all intents and purposes, looks like you would imagine it's like a still surviving dinosaur, but Megalania was a huge monitor lizard that grew anywhere from 15 to 30 feet and lived in the ancient Australian forests and New Guinea forests up to about 10 or 15,000 years ago. And as I said, you know, a huge lumbering thing, far, far bigger than a crocodile, 15 to 30 feet long. And there have been sporadic reports of people seeing these huge lizards in the woods of New Guinea to this day. And, you know, cryptozoology being what it is and a lot of people being superstitious, many of the locals, you know, perceive it as being like a supernatural type creature. But Richard was at pains to point out that, you know, maybe a lot of these reports actually have nothing to do with, you know, cryptozoology in the sense of being something weird, but far more to do with down-to-earth zoology of a creature that science just doesn't investigate anymore because he couldn't believe it could exist any longer. And Richard's spoken with a number of people who've witnessed this creature, and he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Dragons More Than a Myth, and has a whole section on his research into megalania, and he has no doubt that this thing did survive extinction and still exists in some of the more remote parts of that area. And I mean, he made a good case at the lecture as to how and why the creature could exist when you consider the sheer size of some of these forests and the wetlands, and particularly New Guinea, and the very, very seldom explored. There was also a lot of talk about, for example, the big cats in England, and how, you know, although some people perceive them as having paranormal origins, they're also, as well, quite down-to-earth explanations, you know, with people keeping exotic pets that got out of hand and that, you know, got too big for their owners to handle, and that people release them onto the wild moors in the middle of the night and save having them, you know, turned over to the government and destroyed or whatever. So there was, you know, there's a lot of debate on that, and also pointing out the fact that, you know, every year new species of creature are being discovered, usually not anything that big, but, you know, occasionally a new type of deer, which, you know, a deer is a fairly substantially sized animal. Mm. And, you know, Richard pointed out that, you know, you have creatures every year being found, and, you know, so in that respect, a lot of people came along and, I guess, had a new appreciation, not realizing that, you know, as I said, every year countless new creatures are being found. You know, I think there was this belief, well, I know there was a belief, certainly, on certain parts of the audience that asked questions, that they just assumed that whatever was out there, we'd already found it, you know, not realised, particularly in the oceans as well. That was another point that Richard Darren also made, that, you know, if we're going to find new species or ancient species that we didn't know existed anymore, it's probably going to be in the depths of the oceans. And they both, you know, made a point of bringing forth stories on, you know, some very sort of bizarre looking fish that have been washed up or found in the last few years, and that you know, science didn't really know a great deal about, or that, you know, maybe only one or two specimens had ever been found. And you know, I think that's an important point to stress, and that was hit home at the conference, that cryptozoology just doesn't just revolve around lake monsters, Bigfoot and the chupacabras. It actually has a scientific basis in classifying unknown animals as well.
And it's, well, you know, the thing that I think attracts, I know what attracted me initially as a young man, as a child, to cryptozoology was, gosh, you know, there might be real monsters out there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and I think it depends how you define the word or the term monster. You know, I think a monster really is just a creature, a large creature that science hasn't recognized or classified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Bigfoot, technically, if it exists, isn't a monster. It's, you know, it's either an undiscovered type of giant ape or some sort of ape man or something along those lines, in the same way that a Loch Ness monster is not a monster. It's just, you know, if it's a physical animal, it's a creature that science hasn't found yet. So I think, unfortunately, the term monster, it makes, you know, great TV and great publicity, but the image, I think, often works against it because, you know, the mainstream media and science doesn't want to get it. Mainstream media pokes fun often. Mainstream science doesn't want to get involved because scientists are fearful of their reputation if they're seen as investigating monsters. If, you know, if they were seen as investigating perhaps a very rare species of fish in Loch Ness, that might be different, but it doesn't come across like that, unfortunately.
Well, there is that monster woodpecker out there, you know.
Well, that's true.
But those monster giant penguins in Florida.
There you go.
That's just pretty scary. This is embarrassing. I can't remember where I ran across it. There was most likely or the most plausible under-investigated crypto critters.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them mentioned Lake Iliana in Alaska, where I think the most recent sightings are from
might be as late as the 90s, but during the 40s, one of the Bush pilots, and Ileana, even though it's on the southern coast of Alaska, is still fairly remote. There's no direct road access, so you basically have to fly in and out. And it's a huge lake. It's something on the order of 100 miles long, if not longer. But this Bush pilot, overflying the lake, saw near the surface this school, not an individual, but a school of silvery 30-foot-long fish. Mm. Yeah. And one of the other more recent witnesses was on a boat in the lake and spotted these creatures, or at least one of these creatures at a distance, and was, you know, very direct about, well, it was a fish. Mm. It was a very big fish, mm-hmm. but it was a fish. It wasn't an eel. It wasn't a serpent. But, you know, still, that's one of the cases that I've always felt bore a decent long-term expedition, along with the giant salamanders that Tom Slick looked after in the White Mountains in California.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Craig, that, you know, when people kind of knock these stories and just, you know, say it's all nonsense, and actually, a lot of them haven't done sort of the first-hand research or even gone to these locations and seen the sheer size and depth and width of some of these lakes and lochs. I mean, Loch Ness, for example, is 22 miles long, a mile wide, and averages about 700 to 800 feet deep. And the water is, you know, the color of, like, just soup. You know, it's impenetrable, practically.
Having seen a few underwater films from Loch Ness, it's one of those, I wouldn't dive in it.
No. I wouldn't recommend anybody does either. But I think, you know, if primarily the Loch Ness monster, whatever it is, if primarily it's a water-breathing creature, and granted there have been some strange reports on land, but most of the reports, you know, are in the water, if it's something that, or even if it's an air-breathing creature that, you know, doesn't need to surface that often, you know, the chances of actually seeing it maybe very, very slim. Mm. And given the fact that, you know, that the loch attracts more people today than it did 100 years ago, you know, who's to say that the thing doesn't have the sense to, you know, only come out at night now and surface at night for the most part and, you know, stick its head up and do whatever it needs to do. And given the sheer size of it, you know, the chances of actually finding something, well, the loch's impenetrable practically, and it may not need to surface that often, if at all, unless for, you know, curiosity or whatever, then I'm not surprised these things haven't been caught. And that goes for, you know, a lot of the US lake monsters, where you have even bigger lochs, like Craig said, you know, like 100 miles long or whatever.
Yeah,
the chances of being in the right part of the lake on the right day and actually be looking at the loch as well, when this, or the lake, when this thing surfaces, are pretty slim. And again, you know, it's, I think capturing one of these things are elusive, that's, you know, that I think it's going to be difficult. And of course, I'm sure when they die, if they die in the water, you know, the bodies float to the bottom and they just get eaten by the local fish population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chances of actually finding one, a body, the chance of finding a body really relates to if one decides to come ashore and happens to die on the shore. You know, and again, what are the chances of that happening? I think sort of pretty slim. I think it's all, a lot of it is down to chance as to how we actually find the evidence. I mean, you think if a deer dies in the woods, how long does that body last? You know, not long, I'm sure.
So. Not terribly long. I'll cite a couple of really pedestrian examples. Last night, I started taking walks in the evening to try and control middle-aged spread. And my turnaround point is a rather large creek that runs under the main road in our development. I got there just a bit after sundown last night. Actually, it was the first night I walked down there. Like I said, it was a bit past sunset. The creek bed, you could make out details, but I'd say it was probably about no more than 20 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of tickled to see a rabbit hopping along.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at it for a second, and it either sensed me or it decided to take a break, but it stopped, and it virtually vanished. Now, I knew where it had stopped, and a second or two later, it jumped along again. It wasn't Bunny Man. But when it stopped moving, it pretty much became one with its background.
Mm.
You know, and this is an ordinary, recognizable creature. Not optimal conditions, but like I said, I was no more than 20 feet away from it. I was looking down on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, damn the short-term memory loss. I have no idea what the second example I was going to cite was.
Dead deer, maybe?
No.
Well, I think that actually happens a lot. You know, I think people, a lot of people consider animals, oh, they're dumb animals. They're not, you know, they have senses and, you know, a sharper sense of smell, hearing, taste, everything. You know, we walk in the woods, we blunder around snapping twigs, and they just freeze. And I think it's no wonder that, you know, often maybe these creatures, maybe even, you know, Bigfoot-type creatures, if they're flesh and blood, that they have similar attributes and, you know, can blend in with the background to an extent that, you know, we just simply cannot do or don't even appreciate. So, you know, you said the rabbit can do it, who knows what else can do it. And I think, you know, that's one of the problems we do face with a lot of these monster investigations. And I think it was Richard, well, I know it was Richard actually, who mentioned this at the conference. You know, it's the idea that mainstream science and the media always says, oh, well, why don't you catch these things? And for the most part, it's because cryptozoology, it's not exclusive, like a very underfunded discipline. You know, there really isn't an opportunity for most people to do what needs to be done, and that's to sort of spend 6 months or however long at a loch or a lake, or, you know, 3 months on the island of Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabras. Most people have daytime jobs and commitments that don't allow us to do those sorts of researches. And because of that, you know, it inevitably remains under-investigated. And I think the big difference is that mainstream science looks into the so-called respectable things, and they get big budgets and funding to go out and, you know, study the climate in the, I don't know, the Amazon rainforest to see if global warming is affected. And they get results because they have money and the time and the expertise and the manpower to do it. You know, we don't always have that. It's, you know, dedicated, as we said at the beginning of the show, amateurs on their own. And unfortunately, mainstream science is frightened to do that because it hasn't got the guts to do it. And the media laughs at them. So, you know, it's, as Richard said, it's no wonder that we're still sort of looking for answers.
Well, and, you know, it's one of those, I think it's a double-edged sword, or as much the fault, forgive me, of cryptozoology for defining itself as such. You know, I think, you know, Bernard Hubbleman's stands on a pedestal in my world, no two ways about it. But at the same time, he basically created a science that kind of defines itself by its outsideness, its otherness.
Now, you're right there, Craig. That is a good point. I mean, you know, there's no reason why, if you investigate Bigfoot, you should be perceived as being someone who investigates monsters. You know, it actually can be perceived as just an unknown animal. But I think, you know, unfortunately, I think part of it is due to the media, part of it is perhaps our own fault in terms of, you know, not stressing that, hey, you know, we're not nutcases just chasing monsters. We're investigating what appears to be credible sightings of an undiscovered type of ape or, you know, an undiscovered type of water creature or something. And but I think it's, frankly, probably too far gone for the image to be changed now, I think.
Well, at the same time, the hope I hold out is that enough, if you will, accredited zoologists, people like Darren Nash and like Chad Arment of Strange Art, will be attracted to cryptozoology, will be able to do the field work that will result in discoveries like those made in the 90s in Vietnam, where you have was it, I think, four new species of ungulates.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, ranging in size from a goat to a type of ox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing. You know, people get excited over Bigfoot, but they don't get excited over an ox or a goat. But an ox and a goat, they're pretty big creatures to have only just been discovered. That's the important thing, I think, that a lot of people don't appreciate. You know, I think it's more the sensationalist angle that kind of puts like a line between cryptozoology and mainstream zoology, looking for, you know, unknown creatures. But, you know, I think that's just the nature of the subject, unfortunately. It's human nature as well, that, you know, we're fascinated by monsters from an early age. And I think that image is sort of instilled in us and stays with us, you know, throughout our lives to some extent. You know, we all know those little tales we're told as young kids, you know, as a, you know, sort of little folk stories or horror stories around the campfire. And then, you know, they kind of, I guess, bias in some respects or mold our views on the subject as we get older as well.
Well, these mysteries imply the unknown, and the unknown is garbed in fear and monstrousness. And I think it is by virtue of being, I mean, it's no coincidence that Colin Wilson's book was called The Outsiders, right?
Mm.
Well, we're right here at just about 8:30, and I think we might want to save some stuff to talk about for the next show.
Okay.
And just wanted to thank you, Nick, for coming on as usual. Really enjoy talking to you, and I'm really glad to hear about what's going on over in the UK, and glad that there's a conference that's attracting more and more people to look into these strange things. Go ahead and tell people where they can find out all the stuff you're writing online.
Okay, well, I've got several blogs. One is ufomystic.com, which is my regular daily UFO blog. I've got http://monsterusa.blogspot.com, which is my crypto blog. And then I've also got a conspiracy blog, which is Night of the Living Jackboots, or nickredfern.com is my main website. And if you want me on sort of this time next month, which would be round about, I guess, 23rd, 24th of the month, a couple of days after that, I've got my next book out, which is called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, which if you want to discuss that. And that's basically a study of all the crypto stuff I've done since being in the US for the last 5 years. And it covers a lot of Texas things like the Lake Worth Goat Man and the Big Thicket and various other things.
Cool. All right, well, this has been Precognitive Dissonance. I'm Miles Lewis.
And I'm Craig York, reminding you, our listeners, to log into Precognitive Dissonance. Tell us about the show. We'd love to hear what you think. And thanks again to Nick Redfern for joining us this month. We'll see you all next week on Precognitive Dissonance.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks for tuning in.
Happy trails.